Last week we were looking at this lawyer who came to see Jesus in Luke chapter 10 to test him. Verse 25 of Luke 10, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test. He asked the question, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And as a good teacher would often do, he turns it round and says, "Well, let's see how you answer the question. Tell me what you think the answer is." Because it's very easy to immediately give someone an answer to the question they ask, and having answered the question, you discover, well, that's not what they really meant. And you've answered a different question to the one they meant to ask, but for whatever reason they didn't manage to express it properly. So Jesus asks him, "What do you think? What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And he answered by quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 4. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind." And then he quotes from Leviticus 19 verse 18. "And your neighbor as yourself." Note, how is it written in the law? The law is all five books of Moses. Specifically, the law as given to Moses between Exodus and Deuteronomy. And Jesus tells him, "You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." Well, that seems too simple and too easy for the lawyer. What it should have stimulated in the lawyer is to think to himself, "But I don't love God with all my heart and with all my soul and with all my strength and with all my mind. And do I really love my neighbour as myself? I mean, the fellow who lives next door to me is obnoxious. How can I love him?" But Jesus tells him, "You've answered correctly. Do this and you will live." And the lawyer is thinking, "But I don't do this. So what's going through the lawyer's mind? How can I water this down? How can I make it easier for myself?" Desiring to justify himself, he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbour?" And then we get what is called the parable of the Good Samaritan. And we read about four people. We read about the man who is attacked, fell among robbers, he's stripped, beaten, and the robbers leave him alone on the side of the road, half dead. That means he was in a rather bad state. And then by chance a priest was going down that road, person number two. When he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, person number three, when he came to the place and saw him, pass by on the other side. And then verse 33, but a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion and went and helped him. To understand this, we need to understand what is a priest, what is a Levite, and what is a Samaritan, before we can begin to consider what it was that the Samaritan did. Priests were the descendants of Aaron, the brother of Moses. And they were appointed by God in the law to perform the sacrificial services of the tabernacle and then of the temple. It was their responsibility to receive people's sacrifices, and they were to kill the sacrifices and to offer them up on the altar. The priests had to be descendants of Aaron, who was of the tribe of Levi. And the tribe of Levi, the descendants of Levi, were the Levites. And the Levites were not given any portion of the land. When Israel entered the land under Joshua, the land was divided up amongst 12 tribes. But that excluded Levi. You think, hang on, there were 12 sons of Jacob, and if Levi didn't get anything, how could the land be divided up into 12? Well, that's because the tribe of Joseph, you don't read about the tribe of Joseph, you read about the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, who were the sons of Joseph. And so that made it back up again to 12. So you had 12 tribes dividing the land amongst them. The Levites, they were told their inheritance was in the Lord. So they didn't have a normal apportionment of the land. They were given some places to live and to farm. But their main duties were carrying out the functions of the tabernacle and later of the temple. Now, amongst the laws to be found in the law are laws concerning purity and defilement. And if you were to go and touch a dead body, you would be defiled, and you had to go through a certain ritual in order to be cleansed of your defilement. And so if you were a priest or a Levite, you could not carry out the necessary services in the tabernacle, in the temple, and all those associated things which were to be done by these people. And so when we read that the priest was going down that road, he saw the man. Jesus says he's half dead. Well, when you see someone who's half dead, you might think, looking at them, well, he's wholly dead. Some of us would immediately think of a certain film where a certain medical man, I suppose you could call him that, says, no, he's not completely dead, he's mostly dead. But he's not dead. There is still some life left. And so there was a chance of saving the man. But doubtless the priest looked and thought, he's dead. I don't want to be defiled. I'll let someone else deal with it. Walked on. The Levite, likewise, concerned about defilement, looked probably dead, walked by on the other side to avoid defilement. But the man wasn't dead. Were they merely thinking he's dead and we don't want to be defiled? Or were they looking at him and thinking, oh, that's a horrible mess, I don't want to deal with that, thank you very much? We can but guess what thoughts Jesus was thinking about in the minds of the priest and the Levite. Why did these people walk past? Was it merely they didn't want to get involved? Was it because they didn't want to get defiled? We read in the scriptures about David and his soldiers going in to the tabernacle and eating the bread of the presence. This was something that only the priests and the Levites should eat. But they were starving. What was more important? That this bread was used only for the intended purpose, or that it gave sustenance to people who were starving? And Jesus makes this point. When the disciples were accused of walking through the grain fields on the Sabbath and eating the grain, he said, which is more important? There are, as you read through the law, sometimes you get to circumstances where obeying one law conflicts with another law. And so you have to make the decision which is more important. Jesus asked the question concerning one of your animals. It falls into a pit on the Sabbath. What do you do? Do you ignore the animal until Sunday morning? Remember that in the Bible, the Sabbath is Saturday. Do you leave it there until Sunday morning, or, strictly speaking, until the sun's gone down on the Saturday? Do you leave it there? It might die. No, you have compassion on the animal. And so you go and rescue it, even though it's the Sabbath day. There are some rules which are overridden by a greater concern. And that's what the case is here. The greater concern is, here is a man who is half dead. He needs to be looked after. So what, I might be defiled? What is more important is looking after the man. You don't ignore him because, oh dear, I might get defiled. Getting defiled, bad thing. Leaving the man to die, worse thing. We sometimes talk about the lesser of two evils. Here is a situation where there are two things to be considered. Loving your neighbour as yourself, or not getting defiled. Which is the greater command? The greater command is to love your neighbour as yourself. And so therefore they should, knowing the law as they should have done, is to have gone over to the man and looked after him and cared for him. But they didn't. In their minds, a very Pharisaical mindset, what is more important is, I must keep the rules as laid down. And so that's what they did. More concerned about rules than about people. Which is more important? Rules or people? People. Always. They should have gone to the man and helped him out. Then along comes this third person, a Samaritan. Now, for some people, when you hear the word Samaritan, you immediately think of that helpline that when you are feeling suicidal, you can phone up the Samaritans and they will talk to you, and they'll just be an ear to listen to whatever you have to say, and if you ask them, they will help you out to stop you committing suicide. But they won't be in the slightest bit judgmental. They're just a listening ear. So when most people in this country today hear about Samaritan, they immediately think of this helpline. But it's the other way around. The Samaritans took their name from this man. So we need to ask, who were the Samaritans? Well, surprise, surprise, the Samaritans lived in Samaria. Where was Samaria? Samaria was north of Judea. Samaria was what was formerly Israel. First of all, you had Israel under Saul and David and Solomon, which was the whole of the Promised Land. But then following the death of Solomon, the nation was divided between the northern kingdom, which retained the name Israel, and the southern kingdom, which was referred to as Judah, and included the tribe of Benjamin. And by the time the Lord Jesus came into the world, it had been named Judea. So, these people in Samaria, which was based around the city of Samaria, these were the northern kingdom. These were the 10 tribes, the Israelites. No, they weren't. If you turn in the Old Testament to 2 Kings, it's important to do this to understand why Jesus spoke about a Samaritan. 2 Kings chapter 17 and verse 21. When he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Let's talk about the northern kingdom. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit great sin. The people of Israel walked in all the sins that Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. They were taken off from the land into Assyria, and they were scattered throughout the cities of Assyria. Verse 24. And the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. The people of Samaria, the Samaritans, were not Israelites. They came from other parts of the empire conquered by the Assyrians. And they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. And at the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations that you have carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land." You see the pagan mentality. Each land, each area, each civilization has its own God. Silly. There is only one God. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and behold, they are killing them, because they do not know the law of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there." Remember that Jeroboam had corrupted everything concerning true religion. So sending a priest is not necessarily going to be helpful. "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there, and let him go and dwell there, and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. So you had non-Israelites, pagan backgrounds, and a priest with a corrupted religion was brought in to teach them sort of what the Bible said. And it seems, from what we read elsewhere, he only, in fact, taught them the first five books of Moses. He didn't seem to have gone much further than that. The consequence is that the Jews in Judea despise the Samaritans. They were filth. They were dogs. They were not Israelites. They did not have any of the promises of God. These people were scum of the earth. We want nothing to do with them. Indeed, when you turn to John chapter 4, in John chapter 4, reading from verse 3, Jesus left Judea and departed again for Galilee. And he had to pass through Samaria. All manner of things have been written about that verse. He had to pass through Samaria. Was there some compulsion? What was the reason? Well, the reason he had to pass through Samaria was that it's what you had to go through if you wanted to get to Galilee by the fastest route. But that would have meant contact with Samaritans. Ugh. Defilement. Having contact with these godless people, the scum of the earth. So it was not uncommon for Jews to cross the Jordan and go up the east side of the Jordan until they were past Samaria and then cross back again, thus avoiding having to go through Samaria. But Jesus wasn't affected by such thoughts as these, and so he went through Samaria and came to Sychar, a town of Samaria, where Jacob's well was. And Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, a Jew speaking to a Samaritan woman. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, you despise us? How come you're asking me for a drink, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." There was this complete block on the part of the Jews with regard to the Samaritans. And so as Jesus spoke this parable in Luke chapter 10 and mentioned Samaritan, immediately the hackles of his hearers would have risen. I mentioned a certain name in the ears of some people recently, and I did not observe this, but afterwards someone said to me, "You should have seen the face of that person sitting close to you as soon as you mentioned that name. Oh, what a dreadful person. How could you even mention their name? Horrible person." Well, this would have been a bit like that, but with knobs on. A Samaritan? Why are you mentioning the hated Samaritans? But Jesus is pointing out this man, this hated person, had compassion. He might not have been an Israelite. He might not have had all of the Old Testament. But obviously he knew enough to know that he should love his neighbour as himself. And so he went. He's alive. So therefore his wounds need to be looked after. We don't want him bleeding to death. So he bound his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. He needs to be looked after. He needs to be in a place of safety. So he put him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, "Take care of him. Whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back." He didn't ignore him. He saw him. He saw there was a need. He dealt with the need of the man, and he made sure the man was cared for. So, what does Jesus say? What is the lesson to be derived from this? Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbour to the man who fell among the robbers? It's blindingly obvious. Is it even necessary to ask the question? Well, yes it is, because of the animosity towards Samaritans. And the lawyer replies, the one who showed him mercy. You can't even say it was the Samaritan. The one who showed him mercy. Jesus said to him, you go and do likewise. You go and be like a Samaritan. That must have come as a tremendous shock to this lawyer who had come to test Jesus. He was trying to trip Jesus up. Frequently people came to try and trip Jesus up and to get him to say things so that they could accuse him of being opposed to the law or opposed to the Romans. Because if he was opposed to the law, then that puts him out of favour with all good Jews, because the law is everything. And if he's opposed to the Romans, then wonderful, we can get the Romans to get rid of him. That, of course, is what the scribes and Pharisees ultimately did in getting him crucified, making various false accusations against him. But this man, he's come along to test Jesus, and instead he is the one who is tested. He is the one who is made to look at himself and think, how am I living? What should I do? How should I behave? Instead of testing Jesus, he himself was tested. What does this mean for us in practice? It means that whenever we encounter someone who has difficulties and problems, we seek to help them. We seek to alleviate their problems. That does not necessarily mean we give people or do for people what they want. I've mentioned to you on many occasions about how I used to visit a certain flat that overlooked the British Museum, where we had Bible studies, and very often I'd get the tube to Holborn and then walk from there, and very often walking through a small park, there would be people who were always referred to as winos sitting on a bench, and they'd have bottles of sherry or bottles of cider sitting there, usually empty. And they'd often ask, could we spare 10p for a cup of tea? Well, in 1973-74, tea was quite cheap compared to now. Starbucks in those days did not exist. You could not go somewhere like that get a cup of tea or coffee, but there were places where you could. Of course, they didn't want 10p for a cup of tea. What they wanted was to raise money to buy their next bottle of cider or their next bottle of sherry or whatever alcoholic beverage they could get for the cheapest amount. Some of them, sadly, would be so desperate for alcohol that they would even purchase methylated spirits and drink that, which is very sad, because methylated spirits is, I think, 90% alcohol, and it's 1% colouring and 9% methyl alcohol, or wood alcohol. And the alcohol is bad enough, but wood alcohol will blind you. And you'll hear stories, read in books and see in films, particularly older films, about people who have blinded themselves as a result of drinking methylated spirits. But that's how desperate people sometimes get with regard to alcohol. So what do you do? 10p for a cup of tea? Oh yeah, 10p for a cup of tea. There we are, that sorted them out. Doesn't solve their problem at all. It's making their problem worse. Giving people what they ask for is not necessarily what people need. You have to identify a person's need. What we used to do is, when we went to that place, we'd make sandwiches. And we'd take them with us, and so when we were stopped and asked, we could give them some food, because they probably didn't eat any food, because they were more concerned about the booze. The sad thing was that you'd see someone 1 week, and you'd be able to sit down, and as they ate, you could talk to them. And the next week, you'd hope you'd see them again, but it wouldn't be the same person, it would be different people. But dealing with the need, the real need, not with what they ask for. You don't give drunkards, you don't give drug addicts money when they ask. Someone says, I need a cup of tea, you say, oh, well, there's a Starbucks over there, there's a Costa Coffee over there, which one would you like me to take you to? And that's often when you discover what they really want. I was stopped by someone once, I was coming back from lunch at work, could I spare 10p for a cup of tea? I said, certainly, come with me. And we went onto Waterloo Station, and we were actually in the queue. He said, no, and he walked off. He didn't actually want a cup of tea, he wanted money. Another man accosted me when I was going to Dr. Williams Library with some books. Actually, they were probably lectures. He accosted me and said he needed to get home to Berkhamsted and he hadn't got enough money for the ticket. Could I let him have some money? I said, yeah, no problem. Just got to do this first and then I'll come with you to the station and I'll buy your ticket for you. That's not what he wanted. But he stuck with me until we're just coming out of the library and he said, no, the train's about to go. I said, they go every half an hour. It can't be that urgent, which told me that he didn't really want to get a train to Berkhamsted. He wanted money for some other purpose. Just handing over the cash would not have helped him. It was dealing with what he really needs, but I didn't have the opportunity to find out what he really needed. I suspect, he didn't actually say this, but I suspect he wanted money for drugs or for booze. And unfortunately there are people who, a bit like the priest and a bit like the Levite, They don't actually walk past on the other side, but they want to sour their consciences. I know I should do something, but I'll give them the money. They give them the money. They feel better for it. But has it helped the person? Probably not. We live in a very different society to the one in which Jesus and the Samaritan lived. And we now have, funded by the state, which means funded by us, with all the taxes that we pay, there are various services available. And so it's not passing the buck to make use of such services. There was a young man from the former East Germany, and he was homeless. Gordon put him up for a while, but it soon became apparent that this man had mental illness. He said the reason why he was imprisoned on occasions in East Germany was because he was a Christian. But we learnt that no, that wasn't the reason. The reason was, in fact, because of his mental illness. One of Gordon's friends was a local councillor, and he arranged, through social services, for this man to be housed. And he was. We lost contact with him because, again, because of mental illness. And he is now, we know not where. I often think back to a day in August 1973 when I met someone in a bookshop, and he said he was in dire straits and he needed some help with some money for rent. And he'd got this job, but the job wasn't going to pay any money for a few weeks, but his landlord was demanding payment at the end of that week, and what was he going to do? And I didn't know what to do because I was a penniless student. I had some money in my pocket, but it wasn't a huge amount. What could I do? And I was given a lift by someone, and this man was given a lift as well. I haven't a clue what happened to that man, whether he managed to get the money, whether he was evicted, but I always think of that and thought, well, I could have said something to the person giving me the lift who probably could have helped him out. There are things that you can do and things that you can't do. Obviously, God doesn't expect us to do the things that we can't do. But he does expect us to do the things that we can do, that when we come across people who are in need of help, that we do what we can, because that is loving our neighbour. But it's not necessary that we do what people want. Sometimes it's a question of directing people to the facilities that are available. And if someone came to you and said, I'm a drug addict, I want to get off drugs, please help me. And you think, I don't know what to do. But there are services available, provided by the state. We then need to find out what those services are and direct them in that direction so that they can get help. There are Christians who are involved in such things who know what to do. And we need to know sometimes who we need to call in order to get the help that the person needs. But sadly, so often you find they don't really want that kind of help. What they want is cash to buy more drugs, buy more alcohol, buy more of something that in fact won't do them any good. Sometimes we need to put ourselves in the position of the person who needs help and say to ourselves, if I was in their position, what would I want someone to do for me? And that should then inform us how we should behave. There's a verse in the letter of James, in James chapter 2. What good is it, my brothers? This is James chapter 2, verse 14. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm, be filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. so easy when someone is having difficulties, someone's having trials, that you say, I'll pray for you. Well, very good, but I have this immediate need. Just saying, I'll pray for you. There's a Peanuts cartoon where I think it's Snoopy is sitting on his dog kennel and it's snowing and he's freezing. And two of the characters come along and see Snoopy there freezing nearly to death. And they say, go in peace. Be warmed and filled. And they walk off. And then the last cartoon is Snoopy freezing with a bubble, a thought bubble above his head, with an exclamation mark and a question mark. Well, what was that about? That's no help to me at all. We must avoid platitudes. We must think, can I help that person? And what can I do to help that person? After all, what did Jesus do for us? Jesus could have said to us, you're in a mess. You need to get out of that mess. I'll pray for you. He didn't do that. Came into the world as a man, lived and then died on the cross to suffer the penalty for our sins, in order that we might, when we repent and believe, be forgiven. It was his death on the cross that was needed in order to save us. I don't think any of us have yet been asked to die on a cross for the sins of the world, to be alienated from God and suffer the punishment due to sin. There's plenty that we can do, and we should not be like the priest and the Levite and merely walk past on the other side. It's quite possible we might say, I don't know what to do. That's not ignoring the problem. But what we should then do is, I don't know what to do, let me ask someone who might know what to do. And then get advice from someone else who then might be able to say, well, you do this, that, the other. So that the person is helped. The greater law is loving your neighbour as yourself, compared to whatever rule you are afraid of breaking. There are many believers who are Sabbatarians, and there are certain things you must not do on the Sabbath, they would say. But they would also say, whether they always do it or not is another matter, they would also say works of mercy are permitted. And we should not hold so fast to a particular rule that it keeps us from doing what Jesus commanded, firstly to love God supremely, and secondly to love our neighbour as ourselves. And it's hard. When you read that parable and you start applying it, you think, that's hard. And I'm a failure when it comes to keeping that command. Well, thank God that we are forgiven. Not because of our success in obeying God's commands, but because of what Christ did for us on the cross. But it should cause us to reflect and to think, how can I do this better in the future? And we seek to do what Jesus said, not for our own good, but for the blessing of others and the help of others. And this is going to weigh upon us. This man that I mentioned, I regularly think of him and think what I could have done in retrospect, what I should have done and failed to. And considering the man's age, I would suspect that he'd probably be about 105 now, so he's probably no longer with us. But there are other occasions where, stimulated by that failure, I have sought to help people. And often failed miserably. We need to learn the lessons that Jesus gives us and seek to do what he has told us, because it's the right thing to do and because It gives opportunities for the gospel and for exalting the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Let's see how we get on in the week ahead.